in my kitchen. Birds ought to be raining her door.
Come over here, kid. What is up? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water. And you fry some garlic.
It's
and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce. Mouth-titters,
yeah. I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to A Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. How are you doing tonight? Hope you had a great weekend. Certainly was plenty to do, wasn't there? Oh, the Harvest Fair, Calabash, and so many other things. I stayed home. I confess, I stayed home. I've been a little bit under the weather, as are a number of other people. The first of those fall viruses going around, but I'm feeling pretty good right now, and even better when I open my eyes and see what we have here. Yesterday, I think I have that right, there was a tasting of the cheeses of France at Mina Gallery. 10 to 5 free tasting French wines, French cheesemakers, French cheeses. It's hard not to feel good when something like that's going on. And I was able to miraculously get some of the folks involved up here along with some of the cheeses. And I've also brought this evening Lucas Rice Jordan, my grandson, who was born loving cheese with a particular fondness for blue vein cheeses. So I thought he would be a great addition to the show. So we have Mark Saver. Did I say that right?
That's right. Thank you.
Awesome. And Charles Duke.
Yes, thank you.
How was the tasting yesterday?
Oh, my gosh. This is the first time ever at this level that we've brought this variety and this collection of true French cheeses to the people of San Francisco and put them in one incredible venue. We had close to 1,000 people that came through the venue in the course of one day, sampling and trying a range of different cheeses. Mm-hmm. We had demonstrations. We had wine. We actually had explanations of the different kinds of cheeses. So it was a combination of education, and you could actually purchase them as well. So
yeah, at really good prices, I heard.
That's right.
Who put this on?
Well, this whole operation was put together by the French Dairy Boards.
Oh.
They have they run campaigns, promotional campaigns that are paid for by the milk producers and the cheese producers in France, and then those monies are used abroad to promote French cheeses. So right now, I believe they have 5 campaigns going on: one in South Korea, Russia, the European Union, the United States, and Japan. So we're very lucky to have the ability to have that campaign going on in the States, because we get to promote it and to talk about them and to educate the consumer on these wonderful products.
Mm-hmm. I think anyone who pays attention to food knows that French cheeses are high. I mean, they're sort of the touchstone for all other cheeses in the world, I think.
They're the benchmark. They are.
Yeah.
And there's been so much, the United States has been able to create new products that emulate these wonderful cheeses, mm-hmm. in a very good way. I think we're flattering them by producing such great product locally. But these are the originals. These are, mm-hmm. the first ones and the recipes that date back hundreds of years. And they've been perfected ever since. And, here we are with them.
Yeah. Now, does anyone know how many cheeses France produces?
Well, and as Charles de Gaulle.
Right, yeah.
There, how can you...
He said like 258.
248. 248. How can one govern a country with 248 different kinds of cheeses? How is it done?
But that was a low estimate, wasn't it?
That's right. It was.
Yeah, it's like over 400.
Right.
I would say even close to 600 now, yeah. Mm-hmm. New cheeses are still being created as we speak.
One thing I'm curious about, and this part I don't know, in the United States, we have these levels of cheeses. We have, like, Velveeta. We have American cheese. We have those huge bricks of something called cheddar. And then we have, you know, a cream cheese that doesn't necessarily have gum added that's sort of nice, but still... A large production of it. And then we're having, for the last 20 years, just an increasing number of farmstead cheeses. You know, little goat, camembert-style cheese, all different kinds of cheeses. So I'm wondering, is there sort of this parallel, generic level in France? You know, do we have, like, commodity cheese, you know, and then the smaller and more artisan-crafted? Or is it more... I always think of French cheeses as more of the artisan type.
There's all different types, and there are commodity cheeses in France, of course. Yeah, they're sold, they're industrially made, mm-hmm. and they are sold in supermarkets, and yeah, of course. And then you have the different levels of quality, and you do have the new farmstead cheeses. You have cheeses that are new creations that have come about in the last, you know, 5-10 years, which are the new, you know, classics, we can say. Mm-hmm. But there are different levels.
Okay.
The difference is that the quality has always been very good because even though they're industrially made, the quality of the product that's being used to begin with is very good, and I think that it really shows when you taste the product.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you tell us what we have here today?
Well, we came up with a small cheese board that we brought over from some of the products that were being shown yesterday, and. As I'm sure everybody knows, there's an art to create a cheese board. If you ever want to create a cheese board at home, you should try to mix milks, mix textures, mix colors, and that's really the basis of a cheese board. You know, I get a lot of people asking me, how do I do it? And that's just a very simple way. So you want to get some hard cheeses, some soft cheeses, a blue cheese, and just have them very simply presented. And then along with that, you could add fruit or dried fruits or fresh fruit.
Nuts,
or
maybe.
Nuts, confits, jams, etc. So today we have 8 cheeses, 9 cheeses that we brought with us. We have 2 blue cheeses, 1 original Roquefort, and 1 Saint-Agour.
Saint-Agour.
We'll explain the differences later.
Okay.
We have a Comté from the Jura Mountains, which is in eastern France. We have 2 different camemberts, so we can taste the difference between those two. We have a mimolette, which is kind of a gouda. Mm-hmm. We have a Saint-André, which is a triple cream cheese, very dense. It's almost like butter. We have a wash rind cheese called Saint-Albret. And we have this one here...
This is the Petit Pont
l'Évêque.
The Pont l'Évêque. Oh, one of my favorites. And then you also tell us about the wines that you brought and why.
Well
the Côte du Rhône region was sponsoring the wines yesterday. So we have 2 Côte du Rhônes, a red and a white. One of them is a 2010 Héritage, it's called, and the other one is a 2011 Belle Ruche, which is the white wine from the same region. Mm-hmm. So it's a region located in southwest France. Southeast.
Sort of just south of Burgundy, south of Beaujolais and
exactly,
that range.
Yeah.
And I've always found, even when I was a novice wine drinker, I've always found that Côte du Rhône wines are among the most accessible in the world. Really food friendly.
Exactly. Yeah. Not only price-wise, but food friendly because they go with everything. And they're not too heavy.
Yeah, not just ponderous. Right. Like, you know, you have this great Saint-Emilion and it's wonderful, but you really want to be alone and think about it.
Right. And we certainly felt like we were obligated to bring some wine with the cheese. What is sacrilege to not to bring the red and white?
Absolutely.
It's Sunday night. We need to celebrate. We've gotten through the weekend.
Should you feel like opening and pouring, please go right ahead.
Yeah.
when you're tasting cheeses, where a board like this, where would you start?
Well, it's always good to start from mildest to strongest. Mm-hmm. So we want to start off with something that is has a creamy texture, has a mild flavor. So I'm going to suggest we start off with the Saint Andre, which is a very mild, buttery, creamy, buttery cheese. Yes.
Are you looking forward to tasting some of these, Lucas?
Yes. Yes, I am.
This is a soft, ripened, bloomy rind.
Could we compare that, the Saint Andre, to anything else that you might be more familiar with here in the United States?
We can compare this to a brie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we can compare this to a brie. It's a type of brie. It's a triple cream, which makes it extremely creamy and buttery. Extra cream is added to the cheese as it's being made, which gives it a higher fat content and thus a creamier texture. Ooh, I like that
sound.
There's
a nice sound.
I love that.
That wasn't a sound effect. That was the real thing, folks. I just want to say right now.
It's one of Mouthful's favorite sounds.
Merci.
And here comes the next one. The pouring also sounds good. Okay, so in this, the white Cote de Rhone, thank you for the napkin. What are the, I would think, Marsan, maybe if we grab the bottle. Well, I don't know if it's required to say in France.
Let's see here.
Okay, let's see if it says, that is the tiniest font I have ever seen in my life. We'll talk about the varietals on this wine. We're going to give it to Mike, our engineer. He's got better light. Hey, Lucas, I want to know what you think of this cheese.
I like it. I like the texture a lot. And
what is that? Does the texture remind you of anything? Is it like not quite buttery, or is it buttery?
It's not exactly like butter, but it is sort of like a butter texture, and I really like it. It's really good.
It's got just the right amount of saltiness on the finish.
It has an edible rind.
Right, edible rind.
A silky, silky rind, which, you shouldn't be afraid of eating.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yes.
It's really outstanding.
And I think one of the things that we talked about yesterday as well as today was, the proper temperature. You don't want it to be too cold. You don't want it to be too warm. So you need to find the right place in between.
Right. If you're putting together a great cheese board and you want to serve it to your guests, let's say, after dinner, a great way to do it is to take out the cheese, let's say maybe 40 minutes before you're serving it. That way it warms up a little bit to room temperature, and that way all the aromas and the flavors come out.
Yeah, if you eat it too cold, you're wasting all of those fabulous calories.
Exactly.
You really want it to warm up a little bit. It's much more satisfying that way.
Yes.
But this is really just an outstanding Saint Andre.
Yes.
I think one of the things I wanted to share is that in France, when you craft the cheeses, and Charles, you've lived there for many years, you know the story behind it all, but the cheeses are all handcrafted. The cheesemakers will actually go in and rotate the cheeses by hand, and then, as I like to say, they let them sleep, don't they?
They do. A lot of these cheeses are aged for a minimum of 2 to 3 months. Some are aged 24, 36 months. There's an art of this, and there's an actual profession called affineur in France, which is the person who buys the cheese young and takes care of the aging process, which is the most important part, really, of a cheese. Mm-hmm. Aging it is what gives it its value. Mm-hmm. It's a real added value.
And it's not just time of aging, it's also the specific environment in which the cheese ages.
Exactly.
And I think we'll talk about that more when we get to Roquefort.
Exactly.
Okay. So what comes after the Saint Andre? Although I could be totally satisfied living
we could keep eating the Saint Andre.
So good.
We're going to move on to a Camembert. So we're going to taste one of these. It's called Le Rustique.
Now, what is the definitive difference between a Camembert and a Brie?
It's the fat content. It's the amount of cream that's used in the process, and it's also the place of where the cheese is produced.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. I'm making a little mess here.
That's
very
okay.
Creamy.
Yes, it looks like it's somewhat ripe.
Yes. So an original camembert, the traditional recipe, is from Normandy. So these are following a very strict recipe with the milk from Norman cows that are feeding on a very good type of pasture that's... there you go. Here you go. And obviously the pasture and the rain and the wind that's coming in off the English Channel and everything creates this wonderful product that we're putting in our mouths right now.
So you have a more humid environment, foggy.
It's very much in California, actually.
It's somewhere I have been very much longing to go, is Normandy.
Yes.
What I'd really like to do is find a little seaside apartment and live in Normandy or Brittany for 6 weeks
that
or so.
That would be wonderful. There's a lot of cute little villages along the way, like Honfleur. And and here, this cheese is in particular is made in Sainte-Mère-l'Église, which is where the Normandy invasions took place. Oh. So the D-Day beaches and all that is right near the factory where this is made.
Mm. Now, this has some higher notes, higher acidic notes than the Saint-André. They were a little bit deeper.
Right. This is a lot, it has more mushroomy taste to it. The rind is more pronounced, which gives it a lot more flavor.
What do you think of this one, Lucas?
I agree that it's mushroomy. It sort of does remind me of mushrooms, but it's pretty good.
Pretty good?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Do you favor one over the other? The same, you just like them both?
I think I like the other one a little better. But
but the textures are similar. It's also very creamy. I think this is more milky maybe than the other one was more buttery. We can say this one's more milky.
Yeah, I agree.
It's earthier.
And for all the listeners, just so you know, we're not fancy here. We're actually eating the cheeses with our hands. Because why? Because that's the way they do.
Because you can. That's the best way to do it. I mean, we can get fancy and everything, but at the end of the day, the product itself is so good that we really don't need anything else.
You don't need
bread
or crackers to spread it on there. Just
we have some, and I think we might be able to use them between some cheeses just to clean our palate, since we are tasting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, between the tastings. But we could also dress up these cheeses with, you know, honeys and jams, and I think sometimes...
Going down a little further south, a bit of Membrillo.
For example,
some quince paste, as it's called in America, which is, I think, really nice.
With a manchego, with different cheeses from the Basque region. Yeah, I agree.
And when you speak historically, one of my favorite points about cheese is that cheese, as far as we know... There was no internet back then, but as far as we know, it was actually invented as a way to transport milk.
Yes. So. Absolutely, yes. I know that even here in Sonoma County, say 100, 120 years ago, I mean, obviously this is a very hospitable place for any sort of animal, so we had a lot of milk, but we didn't have refrigeration at that point. And so the two commodities that came out of the dairy industry were butter and cheese, and then the liquid from those would go back to feeding the pigs, feeding the calves, that sort of thing. So liquid milk is really more of a...
Well, it's still being done with the whey, which is what, mm-hmm. which is a byproduct of cheese production. And the whey is pumped out now and is used for feed sometimes for the pigs.
And it's good. Little Joey, who you may hear in the background a little bit. Joey usually gets a little bit of whey every day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he eats an all raw homemade diet, and he gets a little yogurt with each meal, and there's often some whey because I use local naturally made yogurts, and so there's some whey, and it's just really good for them.
No, I didn't know that.
So yeah, camembert is one of the most famous cheeses in the world. Books have been written. I almost brought in a book that I have on my shelf that's just all camembert. How much do we know about its history? Do we know how far back it goes? And if we don't, that's okay. We can find that
out
later.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure about how far back it goes, but all these cheeses go back to, let's say, the monastic era of the Middle Ages for the most part. A lot of these cheeses were created as a way to provide protein for people during the long winters, there was not a lot of food.
Yeah.
So they would milk the cows during the summer and the spring, and they would create cheeses which would age during the year, and then they would have all this product available during the long winters. A lot of the abbeys and the friars and those people that were had access to the product, they had the time to create these products, and most people got to eat these products during the long journeys, like the long pilgrimages to like Saint-Jean de Compostelle in Spain that was started off in France, and they would go through that whole route, and every time they would stop for the night, they would stop at inns, at abbeys, where they would be fed cheese, which was the source of protein at mm-hmm. the time.
You know, we are already 20 minutes into the show, and we have a lot of cheese. We should go to the next one.
Let's move on.
We'll move on. Let's try this mimolette.
Oh, the mimolette would come next. Okay. Now, mimolette looks like, for somebody who doesn't know this cheese, they would think it was like, oh, is that a cheddar? Because it's very deep orange.
I assume
that orange comes from annatto.
Correct. It comes from annatto seed, and when you look at the product whole, it's a ball.
Yeah, it's almost like a moon shape.
Exactly. And in these little craters that are here, and I don't know if I should say this, but they're actually created by a type of little animal, a microscopic animal that eats the rind, and actually
is
a byproduct of the cheese. And while it's aging, these animals are at work constantly around the rind, and it adds to the flavor.
Now, I was reading a book. It's probably a good thing that I'm not going to remember the name of the author, but he absolutely trashed mimolette.
Oh, wow.
He just talked about mimolette was, you know, like not a good cheese, and people who like it are, I mean, he just trashed mimolette completely. And I thought, God, and I've always really enjoyed it.
I do want to point out this is one of the most, at the event that we did in San Francisco yesterday, this was one of the most popular cheeses. We saw people not only tasting this, enjoying it, and then walking out with a lot.
I believe it was the number one seller.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I love mimolette, and I've been so happy that for the last decade or so it's been readily available in Sonoma County.
I think we like harder cheeses in the States, and mm-hmm. this is probably one of the best examples of a harder cheese from France.
It's harder. It's, you know,
it's
not as hard as a Parmigiano.
Right.
But it's more firm than, say, typical American cheddar.
Correct.
And it's got a beautiful acidity and then that sort of base note earthiness that the annatto seed, you know, contributes.
Right.
What do you think, Lucas? I don't think you've had mimolette before.
It tastes like I've had it before.
Oh, okay.
But it might have not been the same exact cheese, but from things that you've made me. Mm-hmm.
Do you like this?
Yeah, I liked it. It was sort of different, but I probably would take some getting used to. But
could you imagine cooking with it, maybe? Can you imagine making something with it?
Probably.
Well, one of the things I wanted to point out is that we had Chef Jason Fox, who runs one of the most famous restaurants in San Francisco, Commonwealth. He was actually making some items yesterday. He actually made an amazing albacore tuna with mimolette cheese melt, which was incredibly popular.
Very good.
Tuna melt.
Exactly.
But not like any tuna melt you've had before.
No.
And that's part of this whole campaign that we're trying to promote here, the Cheeses of France. And in, the tagline is called Everyday Perfect. And it's about getting these cheeses into the home and using them on everyday recipes like tuna melt or macaroni and cheese or a grilled cheese sandwich, etc., or a burger.
You know. A perfect grilled cheese sandwich is one of the greatest things in the world, and mimolette makes a great grilled cheese sandwich.
Right, I agree.
Absolutely wonderful.
It's a simple pleasure, but it's delicious.
Yes.
And if you're using good ingredients as your base, it comes through in the finished product. So now we're going to move on to the Conte.
Just before we finish,
I want to say one more thing about the mimolette, and it's an interesting little tidbit, was that this cheese was created in France after the Dutch started taxing it or overtaxing it to the French. And Louis XIV, I believe, said, you know what, we're not going to pay your tax anymore, we're going to make it ourselves.
They were taxing Gouda?
Yeah, they were taxing Gouda, exactly. So this is why this cheese is very similar to Gouda. It's the French Gouda.
I wonder if they added the annatto, if they added the color to
distinguish it. And so the king said, you know, make sure you're only eating the orange cheese, and there you go.
Now, one thing I really like about this is it has higher acidic notes.
It does.
Than the that Gouda, correct. Which I really like. I really like the acidic notes. Now, here we have one of the world's really fabulous cheeses, Conte.
Yes.
There are so many fabulous things you can do in the kitchen with this particular cheese.
This is a great cheese to use as an ingredient on so many different levels. And this particular cheese that we bring in is called... It is actually aged in a gigantic fort that was built during the Napoleonic eras and during the Napoleonic Wars inside the side of a hill in eastern France to protect the eastern front from the Russians. And there's galleries upon galleries of space, you know, that were used for the soldiers to live in. And now, you know, a few years ago, the French government auctioned it off. And Charles Arnault, which is the company that is aging these cheeses, bought it, and you just have rows of Comté.
Now, what is the relationship of Comté to what Americans know as Swiss cheese?
Well, it's a similar texture. It's a similar... Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the holes, for instance, but it's from a similar area. It's an area that's on the French side and of the Jura Mountains and of the Alps. Mm-hmm. So it's at the base of the Alps.
And it's got some flavor components that resonate.
It does.
One of the things we did yesterday, or that Chef Jason Fox did yesterday, because they sure won't let me cook, was to do the Comté grilled cheese with a chilled tomato soup, which I thought was interesting. Oh. And I asked him about that, and he said, you know what? At the end of the day, when you do a soup chilled, it'll bring out the flavors even more.
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan. Lucas and I both, you love cold soups, don't you?
Chilled soups,
yeah. Yeah, I make a lot of soups. And
gazpacho and what?
Oh, gazpacho. We do, one of our staples throughout the year is, it's a potato soup, but it has whatever greens are happening right then from, you know, dinosaur, lacinato kale, sorrel, radish greens. And I try a lot of my recipes out on Lucas, and he likes it. He likes it warm. But he prefers it chilled with a big dollop of whole milk yogurt on it.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, he takes that to he's going to the French American school, and he takes that in his lunch as often as I'll make it.
Very nice.
That was really good.
We have a beret for you, too. Not that you need one, but we have one for you.
You wear it to school.
Now we have this little tiny wedge that you brought that is... That's the one name that I can't remember.
This is called Saint-Albrey. It is a wash rind cheese. It is shaped like a big flower. And each petal represents more or less
So that's half a petal that you have.
Well, the petal's bigger, actually. It's part of the petal. And wash rind cheeses are cheeses that are washed by hand with different types.
It might be an eau de vie.
Exactly. Eau de vie, mar, which is, you know, the grape skins, things like that. This one in particular is washed, I believe, with a type of beer solution.
Yeah, this is definitely getting into the stronger flavors.
Exactly.
We have one thing we haven't talked about is the milk in all these cheeses.
Yes.
The source of the milk.
All these cheeses are made from cow's milk.
Okay.
Except for the Roquefort, which is a sheep's milk. And one of the things we're getting to is to taste the difference between the two milks in the last two blues that we're going to be tasting. But this one, you can see that it has, you know, much more flavor. It's much more pungent.
Yeah. Has it been aged longer?
It hasn't been aged longer, but the fact that it's been washed, the flavors are infused into the paste, which gives it a lot more flavor. And
it's much more sophisticated almost. It's more complex.
It would be appreciated by a connoisseur, yeah.
Yeah, yes. More by a connoisseur, right. Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. What do you think of this one, Lucas?
It was different. It was really creamy.
What did you think of the sort of bitter elements?
Yeah, I'm not much of a bitter fan, like a lot of soups that you've made and cheeses you've given me, or a lot of stuff I've had is bitter, and yeah, it was different, but it was still pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Good. I like it.
Yeah, maybe, you know, next time you if you try a wash rind cheese, maybe you don't want to eat the rind. because it's really the rind that has or keeps that bitterness much more than the paste inside. So for those who don't like the bitterness, maybe they don't eat the rind.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of one of the things I think is most interesting, when you look at a wheel of cheese, the center of the cheese is going to taste different than the outside edge
absolutely.
Of the cheese, very much so, just because of the way that the processing. And when you look at quality cheeses, and you go to work with your local cheese makers, and I can tell you where to get these cheeses in San Francisco if you want. But at the end of the day, it's the center, it's the sections of the cheese. And Charles, you know much more about this than I do.
Yeah, especially these wash rinds where the flavor is going to be much more pungent and pronounced towards the rind.
Yeah, and you know, I like that element of bitterness. I find it really intriguing. And I also find it something that really engages beautifully with condiments. You know, a sweet condiment, maybe a fig condiment, for example, or even the membrio resonates really
Or something
really
savory,
beautifully.
Too, like espelette peppers or something that's much more spicy.
Something with olives, maybe also, a tapenade.
Tapenade, exactly. Yeah. So for those who like sweet, you know, we could add, you know, like you said, the honey and whatnot. But if you're if you want something more savory, exactly, a tapenade or spices.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break now here on Mouthful and come back with more talk about the cheeses of France. Listening to Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. My guests this evening are Mark Saver, Charles Aduc. Both of you. Now, do both of you work for Cheeses of France? Is that the deal?
We both work for various organizations that have been supporting this campaign. Was the Marketing Council to kind of do outreach. I'm based in San Francisco where I work in travel and food and wine and luxury goods. And I think there's nothing more luxurious than tasting these cheeses on a Sunday night. And Charles...
On my end, I'm based in New York, and I work for a big cheese importer and distributor. Mm-hmm. And most of the companies that are backing this campaign are other cheese importers and distributors that work around the country that are helping to bring in this wonderful product and distribute it around the country.
Okay, great. And then our other guest this evening, Lucas Rice Jordan, sixth grade student at the French American Charter School and a longtime cheese lover. So you have cut another one, that square one. So that's another
This one is Compo Levesque.
Compo Levesque. And it's, is that a washed rind?
It's also a washed rind, but it's much more, it's milder than the one we just had.
Okay.
So in reality, we should have had this one first.
And boy, is our engineer loving things tonight.
This is one of the real benefits of working on this show. You get to taste all the cheeses, but you can't taste the wine right yet, but the cheeses are wonderful.
Now, this is not quite as ripe. This
exactly. It's a younger cheese. Yeah, it's a younger cheese right now. It's still a little bit cold, I would say.
Yeah, and you can tell because it's not quite as creamy. And we could go off in this whole other direction. There was a great Frenchman who worked on that whole question of the French paradox and how French people eat a lot of cheese, but yet they have low cholesterol. Serge Reynaud, just a lovely man.
Yes.
And he used to spend, from what I heard, he would spend a lot of time weighing rat feces, depending, you know, to see how they had processed the cheese they were fed, those lucky French rats. And it seemed at the time that the French paradox was first being talked about was the cheeses that are digested by bacteria, which is what ripening is, that those cheeses function much differently in the bloodstream than unripened cheeses, and that they leave, you know, they don't cause any of the problems that Americans have thought cheeses cause. Anyway, all that's just one way to say French cheeses are good for you. Enjoy
they
them.
They are. They are, and I think, yeah, the probiotics that are inside the cheese help you digest easier, and they're part of the, it's a natural product that, you know, we can, yes, it does contain fat, yes, it does contain, but it's all healthy fat, it's healthy cholesterol, and eating it in moderation does contribute to a healthy diet.
Yeah, and I think part of it, if I remember correctly, was the calcium encased the fat, and it left your body, and that's why he was, you know, weighing the rat feces to see how much was being excreted. Anyway, maybe you don't want to talk about that while you're writing the cheese. It doesn't bother me.
But it's definitely part of the French diet. You know, this with red wine and bread, and also portion control. I think that's very important. That's the big difference in France when you're out having dinner or you're being served dinner at a dinner party. Portion control is a big difference between what we eat and what they eat.
Yeah, very natural portion control.
Right.
I think I'm going to go back to the taste issue, which we were talking about before. I think one of the most fascinating facts is when you look at, I mean, you've been to France and you've been to Paris and you've seen the light. If you look at the artists and how they painted the light so much differently, that all has a tremendous impact on agriculture and on food and on the ways that the cows and the animals process the light. And
that's
the
very
gray.
Interesting. Yeah,
and so on a molecular level, we had some butters available yesterday at the event that people loved. Because,
oh, talk about the butter! I love
because we had
French
so
butter.
These different kinds of tastes and textures, and when you go down to the actual cheese level. Go up to the cheese level. You want to look at it. You can actually taste the difference between cheeses from North America and from Europe because of the light and because of the grain and because of the culture and because of the lifestyle and the craftsmanship behind it all.
Yeah, not last week, but the week before last when we had Doralee's Handel from the cheese shop up in Healdsburg. She was on Mouthful, and she brought this French butter. Oh, my God. It's from Normandy, so it's salted. That's the region in France that likes salted butter. It was so good. I've eaten it all now, and I have to go up to Healdsburg to get more
and
of it.
And I wanted to bring some, Michelle, for you, but unfortunately they sold out
all
yesterday.
Of it.
So I
well, we'll have to talk.
Any, but I'll ship you some.
Yes. Yeah, I'm actually working on a book about butter.
Oh, okay, very
and,
good.
And the differences in butter. I find them so it's so interesting to me, and I think that's one of the real signal ingredients that goes directly to terroir.
Yes, exactly, you know, and that's a great
so
segue because that's what
place.
I was going to say. Yeah,
okay.
I think to sum up what Mark just said, we can sum it up in French in one word, which is terroir, and that's what it's all about. It's the sense of place, the ingredients, and the way that these cheeses are made follow a very strict recipe that has to do with the type of animal, the type of feed, how much the animal spends outdoors, how much the animal spends indoors during the winter and eats hay, how much of the pasture land is. Everything has to do with terroir, and that is transferred into the milk and thus into the cheese, and you know, there it is. We can taste it.
And I just want to add one of the other things. I think there's a real craftsmanship behind this, and that's one of the things that, on a personal level, that I'd like to see more craftsmanship in our food, in terms of just taking care of things and making sure that you can actually taste. I believe strongly you can actually taste something when it's been cared for even better.
Oh, I completely agree with you. Absolutely. There's an individuality to something that has been cared for that I think doesn't exist, and they don't want it to exist in something that's more commodity level. Because commodity level, you want it to taste the same in 1956 as you do in, you know, 2012. You want consistency, not character. So, Lucas, what did you think of that last cheese we tasted, the Levesque?
It was a little different, but...
In a good way, or did you not... Did you like it as much? Was it a favorite or not a favorite? And anything's okay.
I didn't like it as much as the other ones. But, yeah, it was really different. I don't think I've ever tasted a cheese like that before. And
It had a more rubbery consistency than the ones we've been eating.
Yeah,
it's not as creamy and...
Not as delicate.
I actually thought it was going to be more creamy, and I was expecting to... With the other ones, I just put my finger in it, and I tried that with the other one, but it was just like... Then I realized, hey,
This also was an example of a cheese when it's younger. Is if that cheese spent another, 4 to 6 weeks aging, it would become creamier.
Correct. And also if it was a little bit warmer, maybe.
Yeah. Mm.
So I took out some flatbreads and some crackers just so I could spread the blue cheese out easier.
Okay.
I think it might be a little bit harder to eat it with our hands.
While you're doing that, I'm going to ask Mark, I think we should try the red wine.
Absolutely. I'll move forward and open that up as I grab the bottle.
So this is going to be our last cheese.
Our last two,
blue,
right?
Our last two, the two, last two blues. I'm going to start off with a Saint Agur. So it's Saint Agur, A-G-U-R. And the difference between the two is the type of milk.
Okay.
This one is made with cow's milk, which is going to give it a creamier texture and a milder flavor. So I'll start off with a milder one. Now, this cheese has a high water content. Cheeses age, moisture evaporates. So that's why cheeses that are very hard, for example, a Parmigiano-Reggiano, et cetera, have very little water or moisture content, and you could actually almost leave them outdoors, outside of refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
While these cheeses that are very wet need to be refrigerated, because otherwise, you know, that's where bacteria grows, and that's what might not be as good.
Here you are, sir. Merci.
So, Michelle, I shall pour.
Okay. So this is a cow's milk.
Héritage. Oh,
nope.
This wonderful
what a save,
héritage,
huh?
Yeah. Côte de Rhône.
Okay, so a Côte de Rhône red.
Côte de Rhône red.
Now, blue cheese, by definition, is in part salty.
It is.
And what is that? It's rubbed with salt, correct?
It's rubbed with salt on the outside, and then it is poked with its holes are made into the cheese so that the cheese can welcome the Penicillium roqueforti, which is the type of bacteria that's used, or the type of mold that's used to make this cheese.
Like with is it a metal?
They're metal rods, that are poked into the cheese when it's still white and new and fresh. And the mold enters it and grows within the moisture of the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So the cute little story behind all this is that originally they say that it was discovered by a shepherd that was falling in love with this girl who was who lived in the area, and he was tending to his sheep, and he had some fresh cheese with him, and he had a loaf of rye bread, and he saw the girl coming by, so he ran over and left the cheese and the bread inside a cave to keep it for later, and then he forgot about it because he started talking to the girl and et cetera, et cetera. And when he came back a few months later, he remembered he had left that in the cave, and the rye bread had molded. And so the spores of the mold that were created in the bread had transferred over to the fresh cheese, and thus the creation of Roquefort that was in the caves of Roquefort in France.
That is so French. That is just such a French story.
L'amour, yes. Et le fromage.
Yes, l'amour et le fromage.
This, I wanted to point out, if you notice the unique packaging on this.
Yes, it's a wedge-shaped plastic container.
Right, and that is actually enables the cheese to be preserved even better and maintain its form and shape and...
exactly. And we have a 5 it's a 5-ounce wedge that's in the Senegor.
Now, Lucas, being a fan of blue cheese, what do you think of this one? Do you love it as much as I do? I really like this.
I don't know. It's very strong, but I do like it, especially on this cracker. And I thought it was really good. It really tastes like blue cheese.
I love the texture. It's really smooth on the palate, but with those beautiful, pungent blue cheese notes. It's really exactly. Lovely.
And it's beautiful. And if people want to see more, there's more at cheesesoffrance.com.
Oh,
you can go there
yes.
And see photos, see information. You can learn more about
all
the
cheese. It's a great website.
And we can tell more about that. And within, if people in the Bay Area, Whole Foods has a number of these cheeses. And
Molly Stone's.
I bet Oliver's in Sonoma County. There's 3 Oliver's here, and they have really excellent cheese.
I'm sure they do.
Mongers, really good.
These cheeses are available also online.
You can buy them online as well.
You can buy them online at afinashcheese.com. They're all available and shipped overnight.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, I like blue cheeses in general, but this one I have not tasted before, and I'm
good.
Very much enjoying it.
Santagur,
yes. A-G-O-R-E?
It's A-G-U-R, Santagur.
Santagur, yeah. Okay.
So now we're going to taste another blue cheese, and this is the original Roquefort, which is following the traditional recipe of sheep's milk. So I think we're going to see probably even a stronger flavor and a mm-hmm. different texture.
This is sheep's milk,
We're getting out our crackers, you guys.
The milk makes, whatever the milk is,
right.
Makes a huge difference. Now, are there any blue cheeses in France made with goat's milk?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of any.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Here in the States, I know that we have one original recipe, which is made up in Oregon, which is a lovely blue cheese that is smoked mm-hmm. for those people who like a smoky flavor.
Oh yeah, that smoked blue is
You've
very
had it
nice.
From our
I've
friends
had it.
Over at Rogue Creamery.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very nice cheese.
Yes,
both of these blues were incredibly popular yesterday.
1,000 people—that's really great.
We were just shy of that number, but mm-hmm. considering the plethora of opportunities for activities yesterday.
Oh my God, what was going on yesterday?
We were delighted to see everyone that came down, and so thank you for everyone who came.
Okay, this is... You happy now, Lucas?
Mm-hmm.
You love this, don't you?
Mm-hmm, especially with some anchovies.
Oh, wow. That's right. He loves
You're
blue
very
cheese
adventurous.
With anchovies.
Nice.
Well, I like the anchovies soaked in vinegar for a week.
Wow. Do you put that on anything, or do you eat them by themselves?
Yeah, I eat them with feta, blue cheese. I eat it on crackers.
With some membrillo alongside?
Yeah. Sometimes like in the salad, but yeah, I really like anchovies.
Yeah, it's really pretty amazing to have this.
Very
little,
amazing.
Little,
little gourmand
who likes
in the
anchovies.
Making. Yes. So this cheese is very good because you can crumble it into a salad. You can place it on a burger. I know that I've been to many restaurants where, a hamburger, blue hamburger is mm-hmm. very popular.
Oh, yeah.
And it adds just a lot of flavor to salad dressings, to a host of
I love to
recipes.
Make, if I'm feeling ambitious, I love to make a Roquefort souffle.
Mm.
It's a really nice dish.
Well, it's history, in my opinion. Every time I taste a Roquefort, I think, well, there's only seven companies in the entire world that are making this cheese. And
there are, what is the area of France?
Well, Roquefort is located in the southwest of France.
Is it in the... It's not the Languedoc.
It's close to it. It's in between Languedoc and Pyrenees.
Oh, okay.
So it's right there. It's a little pocket of area located right in between those two regions. And only cheese made there, only this blue cheese made there can have the name Roquefort on it.
Now let's talk about those requirements, the designation of origin.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
So right now, in France, originally, these designations were called AOC, which is Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée. Now with the European Union in place, they're referred to as PDOs, so it's Protected Designation of Origin.
Really?
Here in the States, for instance, a PDO.
About the change. I'm still doing the AOC.
Yeah. It's the same thing, and you can use the two terms interchangeably. Mm-hmm. AOC, PDO, depending on where what you're referring to or what country, they have a little different.
Yeah, I think it's Italy is DOC.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So this is very important because I'm sure we all know about the story about champagne and how only sparkling wine that's created in champagne
in
or made
California,
in champagne can be made.
You can't call
champagne.
It champagne.
Right.
In California, you cannot call it Beaujolais.
We make the sparkling wines.
Yes, exactly.
Sparkling wines. And other countries are starting to get on the same bandwagon where they're saying, look, we've made this forever. It's ours. It's our recipe. Only the real thing comes from here. And I know that France and Mexico, for instance, are in talks right now for tequila to have an AOC type of appellation where only, that eau de vie from that area in Mexico can be called tequila. And the French are respecting that because they want the same respect
good,
on the
good.
Outside.
Yeah. Interesting. I hadn't realized that was going on.
No, it's going on right now. And certain cheeses as well in Mexico that are looking for that AOC. And we have it here to a certain extent, but it's never been regimented by the government.
Mm-hmm.
We have, Florida orange juice, and we have Jersey tomatoes, and we have Idaho potatoes, but there's no real rules.
That makes me think of something that I just got in the mail yesterday, I guess. I found a company that carries a really broad range of peppercorns from around the world, and I'm looking for the best pepper in the world, which has not been available in the U.S. for about 4 years, and I found a company that might have it. But one of the other things they were selling was a salt called Sonoma Pacific Kosher Flake Salt. It's like, what? We don't have a salt industry in Sonoma County. So I've got to do a little research about where that's right. coming from, because it's definitely not salt from Sonoma.
And that's a good point, because there's a difference between protecting something where it's locally made and marketing.
Exactly. For a very long time, I think all through the 80s and the early 90s, the California Olive Oil Company was based in Boston. Right. And what was in the bottle had absolutely nothing to do with California. And when the California Olive Oil Council, we had the Olive Oil Renaissance and the Olive Oil Council formed, they've actually gotten that to stop.
Good.
They don't have that name anymore. So, it's interesting, marketing versus, description.
Exactly.
It's important. So
that's why I think it's really key to get out and taste and try some new things and visit your grocer and ask questions.
And ask questions.
I think people, I know even for me on my own side, I get stuck in a rut because I do the same thing again and again. So it's good to meander to the edge of your grocery aisle or the edge of your market and try a vegetable you haven't had before or try a unique cheese. And I think there's a great example. There's a whole world of cheeses out there. There's all 248 and I've only gotten through a handful of them.
You only got through six today.
Yeah, and one of the great things to do, I think, is to develop a relationship with your cheesemonger or your vegetable man. Develop relationships. And what happens is you get to learn. You get to understand where that person is working. But more than that, I think, that person remembers you. And they'll think of you and think, I have something you'll really like.
Exactly.
And so much of shopping in America has become anonymous. So, God, those grocery stores where you check yourself out with some sort of electronic thing just drives me nuts. It's like you want that relationship with another human that will understand you and start introducing you to things.
Correct.
So that's one of them. And we have that at Oliver's. I think we have that at Whole Foods. We had that, in spades at Traversos, and Traversos has been closed for not quite a year now, and that's very sad, but I keep thinking they're going to reemerge. We had a caller a little bit ago, and I wanted to revisit some of the questions that they had. We had talked early on about what was a brie, what was similar to a brie, and what the story about these bloomy rinds is. When you see a rind, like I'm looking at this beautiful uncut camembert, that has that bloomy rind, are they always edible?
Yes. Yes, always edible.
Yes, yes, always edible.
Always edible. A white mold is a good mold. Mm-hmm. It's edible. It's not very, it's very thin. Mm-hmm. A lot of the flavor is concentrated in the rind.
So if you don't want that concentration of flavor, don't eat it.
You could just eat the paste, yes. Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, that's sort of like,
it would be a shame.
That's sort of like eating the inner part of the bread and throwing away the crust.
Exactly, exactly.
You really want to get used to that whole thing. And then that term brie, which so many people think of, is brie an umbrella term that refers to lots of different cheeses, or is brie a specific cheese?
Brie is actually a specific cheese, and the name of brie is there's an authentic brie in France, which is Brie de Meaux, which is a town.
M-E-A-U-X,
correct,
is it? Yes,
yeah.
Brie de Meaux.
And Brie de Meaux is a place, Meaux is a place located, I believe, west of Paris, and that's where brie originated.
I think they have a really good mustard, too. Moutarde de Meaux.
They do, yeah. So that's, but now, you know, any type of bloomy rind, soft ripened cheese that resembles a brie is brie. It's become a generic term, like, mm-hmm. you know, any cheddar.
Now, one thing that, you know, I've come across a few times is living brie versus non-living brie. And the non-living brie are those big round things that you see in places like Costco that are not refrigerated. They're sitting, they seem to have like a nuclear age shelf life. What's the story? Do we know what that difference is? Has there been a process that stops the ripening that allows them to be shelf stable? Or if we don't know, that's okay.
I'm not sure. I mean, the brie that comes from France is refrigerated, and is refrigerated,
yes,
from the moment it's made all the way to your store. Those cheeses that are shelf stable, I've never had.
I just think avoid them.
Yes,
you know, when you see this huge like 12-inch round of brie on a shelf in, I don't know, Target, Costco, whatever, probably don't buy it. It's not a bargain.
I would avoid it. I think it probably has been radiated, if anything.
Irradiated, kind of.
Some of the milk that Parmalat or certain milks that are sold in bricks, you know, those cardboard boxes.
Right, those have been irradiated. Yes.
So I would think it's
similar
to that.
That makes a lot of sense.
I do want to say that Costco has done an amazing things lately, and people
let's
might not
denigrate Costco. Yeah, I've been to Costco. I was actually
Are they doing some of these kinds of cheeses as well now?
This and more. I was very impressed with Costco. I went to visit the Livermore store actually a week ago, and I was very impressed with the selection. So I think that right now the American customer has become very sophisticated with cheese, as it did with wine a few decades ago. And we're seeing the renaissance on the market, especially for companies like the ones that were represented yesterday. The American consumer is looking for a new taste experience. They're looking for higher quality products. Mm-hmm. We've traveled. We've tried things abroad, and we want to recreate that same experience at home.
Excellent. That is really good news. Lucas, how was that Roquefort? You happy?
Yes, I'm very happy.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on to Mouthful.
You're welcome.
Which one is your favorite cheese, Lucas?
Probably either the first one or the
Saint Andre.
Mm.
Yeah, that one or the one of the last two blue ones.
Okay. And on that note, we are just about out of time. So thank you. I know time flies on Mouthful. Mark Saver and Charles Duke. And if we want more information, is cheesesoffrance.com the best place to go? Cheeses of France. And as always, you can send me an email asking questions about any of the things we've talked about tonight. You can also like Mouthful on Facebook. Just look for Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode. And in the meantime, take care of yourself and someone else too. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Au revoir tout le monde.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We've got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord, let the praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat.
Then the mama's in the kitchen.
Oh, yes, she is.
She's been there all day. I know she's cooking something good, so let's go.
And the moral of this story, well, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.
Got some beans and good cornbread. Listen to what the preacher said.